Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. I am so excited to share today's episode with you. For those of you who follow my Substack, you may know that I've decided to make my way through John Steinbeck this year. We started with his second work, Pastures of Heaven, a short story cycle that comes a few years after his first publication called Cup of Gold, which was a historical novel set in Mexico. We decided to skip this first book as Pastures of Heaven turns our gaze specifically to California. I was blown away by this short story cycle and wrote my initial reactions to it on my Substack. After finishing each volume in Steinbeck's oeuvre, I will plan to have a podcast discussion with experts about the book, providing readers and myself the additional context and analysis to make the reading experience richer. And we are fortunate enough to begin this podcast series with the titan of Steinbeck study, Dr. Susan Schillinglaw. Born in Iowa, raised in Colorado, Dr. Schillinglaw graduated with a BA in English and Art from Cornell College and a PhD in English from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She is a professor emerita of English at San Jose State University, where she was the director of the university's Center for Steinbeck Studies for 18 years. In 2012-2013, she was named the SJSU President Scholar. She was also the director of the National Steinbeck Center in Salinas. Dr. Schillinglaw has published widely on John Steinbeck, including Carol and John Steinbeck, A Portrait of Marriage, published in 2013, On Reading the Grapes of Wrath, Penguin, in 2014, and A Journey into Steinbeck's California, published in 2019. She's also wrote introductions to several of Steinbeck's books for Penguin New American Library editions. Her most recent title is Steinbeck's Uneasy America, Rereading Travels with Charlie, which she edited with Barbara Hevlin. This collection puts together critical scholarship on John Steinbeck's best-selling late career travel memoir. In 1960, Steinbeck was a renowned man of American letters. Many considered him America's troubadour of ordinary people, the conscience of the country. But weakened by two small strokes and anxious that he'd lost touch with America, he embarked on a cross-country road trip accompanied by his wife's standard poodle, Charlie. 2 years later, he published Travels with Charlie to popular acclaim and robust sales. In this episode, Dr. Schillinglaw and I discuss Steinbeck's continued relevance, pertinent biographical information that informs our reading of this particular text, themes and structure of the Pastures of Heaven, character analysis, and interpretive tools needed for an enriched reading experience. I hope you enjoy this conversation and that it ultimately encourages you to pick up the Pastures of Heaven. Let's go meet Dr. Schillinglaw. So, Dr. Schillinglaw, I want to start with kind of an easy question. What's your favorite Steinbeck novel? And then part two, what do you think is the most underrated work by Steinbeck?
That's not such an easy question. It depends on what I'm thinking about and what I'm writing about and maybe teaching in terms of what's my favorite Steinbeck book. I love The Grapes of Wrath, and I've written a book about The Grapes of Wrath. And so I read it over several times to write the book, and the language is just beautiful. It's really Steinbeck at its height in terms of his use of language. I think Of Mice and Men is a little gem, and it brings up lots of social issues that I think are naughty, but should be discussed: gender, race, inclusion. So I think it's a book that, even though it uses the N-word, that should be read by every ninth grader. I really love Sea of Cortez, which is nonfiction, book published in 1941, but it's his ecological statement of ecological holism. And it really has, as one reviewer said, more of the man, John Steinbeck, than any other book he wrote. So I think that's a wonderful book. It depends on my mood and what I'm thinking about, etc. So
let's say you were teaching a 12th grade English class. Which Steinbeck would you assign them?
Oh, wow. I have taught 12th grade, and it really depends on the level of the students. You want students to like reading, above all. That's the goal. Reading should be fun. I once had a student say, I picked the Potato Peel Pie Society as a book to begin the class with. And one student said, oh, that was such, why did you pick that? Such an easy book. And I said, I thought it would be fun. And on the evaluation at the end of the course, he said, "Never before have I heard an English professor say reading should be fun." And if we don't think reading is fun, we're in trouble. So I think some books are harder than others. Some books challenge you more. Some books you can't breeze through, some you can. But the act of reading should be interesting, challenging, pleasurable, fun in different ways. And I think that's really important. So for 12th graders, if it were an advanced class, I might teach The Grapes of Wrath. But to some extent, I don't know if high school students have had the life experience to think about poverty and dispossession. And I've had more success in college classes teaching The Grapes of Wrath. I think The Pastures of Heaven would be a good, I have taught that, and it's, students love it. They love short stories, and Book of Interconnected Short Stories is fun. So I might teach that. I might teach his other collection of short stories, The Long Valley, or Of Mice and Men. There are lots you could teach. If the political moment were right, he wrote a book about occupied country during World War II, The Moon Is Down, and that's popular because it has a really interesting backstory. Just depends on the class.
Where did your interest in Steinbeck come from?
That's a good question. I went to graduate school at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And so we didn't really talk about Steinbeck. It was Faulkner and Southern writers all the way. And so when I got to California and began teaching, I was asked to direct the Steinbeck Center at San Jose State, where I taught. And I had never directed anything or written grants or launched a conference, but I said, sure, I'll do that. And I basically scrambled to learn about Steinbeck. And he grounded me in the state. Reading Steinbeck made me love California. I'd been here when I was young. I had aunts who lived here, but just to live here, he really taught me to appreciate the landscape, the people, the sense of place in particular. That's how I stumbled into becoming a Steinbeck scholar. But I did it with enthusiasm and energy and met a lot of his friends who were still living when I first started out. So it was fun.
I'm a bit of a dilettante, and I often wonder what it would be like to be with someone like Steinbeck for a large portion of your career. Is it like with like good wine, it like ages, or is it like a relative that just doesn't want to leave your house?
I did teach American literature, and I love Faulkner. And so I taught Faulkner seminars, graduate seminars. I taught Western literature. I taught film. I taught creative nonfiction. So I didn't just teach Steinbeck, although right. I did teach Steinbeck every year for some 34 years. No, I didn't get tired of him. I didn't get tired of him because students liked Steinbeck. They enjoyed the class. They enjoyed the reading. He's genial. He's approachable. He's empathetic. He's a lifelong Democrat. There was lots that students could just embrace. In terms of my career, do I ever get tired of him? No, because he was really a writer who was, let me backtrack a bit. In 2002, for the centennial, a group of us were struggling with sort of a tag for the Steinbeck Centennial, what we're going to do after 100 years. And engaged artist is what we came up with, or troubadour of the common man, except for we wanted man and woman, which sounded a little clumsy. But that's really what he was. He really championed democratic values. And that immersed him really in politics and social issues and wars and foreign affairs and with presidents, et cetera, throughout the 20th century. So if you're, thinking about teaching, researching Steinbeck, you're looking at the Depression. He wrote about World War II as a journalist. Post-war, he went to Russia to look at, write about post-war Russia. He wrote travel literature. He went to Vietnam in the 60s. He was friends or associates, at least, with presidents, certainly Roosevelt, Kennedy. Jackie Kennedy wanted Steinbeck to write her husband's biography after he died. And he knew Lyndon Johnson very well because his wife had gone to school with Lady Bird. So that's that engagement with the political and social life of our country is endlessly fascinating. So you're always turning over ground of the 20th century. In addition, I was just in Mexico, actually, at the San Miguel Allende Literary Conference, which was wonderful. And I did a paper on Steinbeck and Mexico. And over a third of his books are either set in Mexico or about Mexican-American characters. He was obviously it's hard to be in California and not engage with the Mexican culture, but he was really very much interested in Mexico, Viva Zapata, the film, The Pearl, Forgotten Village, a little documentary. So that's interesting too.
Yeah. I've got a couple questions about biography because we're reading through Steinbeck sequentially. We are skipping the book that's set in Mexico to start, but we'll talk about that in a second. I do want to ask you, so it's been interesting for me to read his biography because I hadn't before this. I'd read his novels, but I didn't know an incredible amount about his life. I know his mother was deeply influential in terms of his literary development. What role did his father play in his early life? I read less about that or saw less about his influence.
Which biography are you reading?
Oh gosh, I don't have the title in front of me. I'm embarrassed. Let me see. Just looking it up real quick. Sorry.
It doesn't matter.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah. I don't remember it offhand.
Anyway, his mother had been a school teacher. She was determined that her four children be well-educated, that they be introduced to things like music and opera. Steinbeck took piano lessons. She took them on enrichment trips to San Francisco. She was very much involved in the community in a book club called The Wanderers that read about various countries around the world. So she really loved education and loved reaching out and being socially and to some extent politically engaged. His father was a quieter man, a little bit depressive at times, but also had a real moral integrity. So I think from his father, he really appreciated a sense of probity, moral probity. And he, even though he thought his father was somewhat disappointed as a businessman, he was let go at Sperry Flour Mill in Salinas when John was 11. And so was depressed about losing his job because the wheat profitability plunged. So in some ways, his father is a little more difficult to read, in short. I think that one biography says, oh, Steinbeck's father was a failed businessman. And in some ways, again, he was a failure, but he pulled himself back together. He had other positions, but he always represented, I think, a kind of moral compass for Steinbeck. And his father loved the land. He was a gardener. He wanted to be a farmer. And Steinbeck's love of the land was a lifelong love.
Okay. Why didn't Steinbeck finish at Stanford?
He never wanted to go to Stanford. His mother wanted him to be a banker or a lawyer or something. And he went dutifully to school because his parents wanted him to go to school. His two older sisters had gone to Berkeley and Mills College, and he was expected to attend college. So he went.
He was there for a long time, wasn't he? Almost 6 years, something in that range?
No, he wasn't. That's the span of years that he was maybe partially in attendance, but he dropped out often. So he dropped out after two quarters, and then he came back, and then
itinerant.
Yeah.
In and out. Yeah. Yeah.
For almost 2 years, he dropped out to work in the fields. And so he just took basically the course he was interested in, writing courses, world history, loved world history, as you can tell from all of his books. He has frequent references to, pointed references to world history. So he took what he wanted and then never really intended to graduate. So left without taking a degree in 1925, left happily.
A lot of writers go east and don't come back. I think the Joe Didion kind of example, even though she did come back and write a lot about California on and off throughout her career. Are there things that are Eastern in Steinbeck that he acquired in his time in New York that you can see? Or do you see that as a blip in his biography that doesn't really represent itself in his fiction?
If you think of Steinbeck was born in 1902, and he really wanted to put his land, as he said, my California, my valley, on the map of the world. Now, what that meant, nobody had written about Central California at that point, except for poet Robinson Jeffers, who moved to Carmel in 1914. But Steinbeck wanted his voice to be heard. So he was determined to be a writer at about age 14. So I think that the California novels resonate most with people because he was so grounded in California in a sense of place. and he called it My Country. And so I think that makes those California books, the books about love of place and a kind of topophilia, if you will. And when he moved east, it wasn't that he loved New York City. He wrote some really good articles about New York City and Long Island, where he had a summer home. He loved being by the ocean. So he really moved to a town, Sag Harbor, that was very much the town where his parents had a summer home, Pacific Grove. So did the East affect him? I think his third marriage affected him. His wife was very much in love with New York City. And I think she introduced him to theater, to a lot of travel, he became more comfortable socially. And so he wrote more travel articles. And a lot of people think he didn't write as effectively once he left California. That can be debatable in things like Travels with Charlie and Wind of Our Discontent. But probably his best fiction is about California. But I don't think he lost his voice in New York City when he moved east. It just became different and perhaps not as intensely place-based as is the California fiction.
Okay. I want to ask about his first wife, Carol Hinning. Is she a Lee Krasner type, like Jackson Pollock's wife, an equally talented creative type that kind of gets subsumed in their partner's art and becomes a support structure? Is that the way we should understand her? Or how would you characterize her role in her relationship?
I wrote a biography of their marriage, Carol and John Steinbeck. And yes, that is generally how I see her. I think her creativity was more hit or miss than sustained. She wrote poetry. She did really lovely little satiric pictures of nude women, sports figure. She was a great editor. She would have been a great editor in New York City had she lived there. She wanted to do journalism, and she was interested in gardening. It's just her interests were spread out creatively. She was very creative, very smart person, very avid reader. So yes, she inspired him. She came up with titles for his books. She was one of those things. I just taught a course about women in the shadow of men, about creative women who had their own, in some cases, very, very rich and fruitful creative outlet. And Carol did, but hers went in many directions. So I think that, but she definitely, he wouldn't have been the writer he was without Carol, chiefly because she was so tough an editor, and he needed that. He needed somebody to pare down his language, which started out being very florid, musical, and a little bit overwrought. And she was the one who said, stick with the details when he was writing Grapes of Wrath, eliminate adjectives, what Hemingway was doing in some ways.
Okay. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, just clarity.
Okay. Before we jump to Pastures of Heaven, I want to ask you, as a book club, are we making a mistake by skipping Cup of Gold?
No, I usually started out with To a God Unknown when I taught Steinbeck, because that was his second written and third published novel. And it's really interesting, and it's overwrought, but it's so ambitious about humans, land, spirituality, a kind of holistic sensibility, place. It's so quintessentially Western, a really interesting book. So I start out with that. But I think starting out with Pastures of Heaven, which was his second published but third written, is equally valid. Cup of Gold is interested in the global South in terms of exploration, wanting to, having a dream, setting out to have this global vision and this. So you see again a dreamer. So no, I don't think it's problematic to skip to Cup of Gold.
Okay, let's talk about The Pastures of Heaven, which I loved. I had never read it before. I'd read the big ones. I'd read Of Mice and Men. I've read East of Eden. I'd read Grapes of Wrath and dipped in a few other places. But this is my first, Cannery Row is probably one of my favorites. But this is my first time with Pastures of Heaven. And the short story cycle is interesting. I read about kind of where it's speculated that it originated in terms of influences for him. I saw Dubliners perhaps as an influence, a Sherwood Anderson book that I hadn't read, Winesburg, Ohio. Is that where this came from? And can you explain what's the purpose of choosing like a short story cycle as opposed to like a big novel? Like last month I read a big Russian novel called Life and Fate, and it's got hundreds of subplots, it feels, in many subsidiary characters, but What's the function of choosing a short story cycle?
I think he was, first of all, he was writing short stories to break into the market because the short story market was really profitable in the 20s. Think of F. Scott Fitzgerald. And in the 30s, it was still a lot of publications, Saturday Evening Post, et cetera, were publishing short stories. That's why he was focused on short stories. He was trying to make a living as a writer. Think of this, in 1932, when Pastors of Heaven was published, he's 30 years old and he's really struggling to support himself. And he didn't make any money at writing really until Tortilla Flat when he was 33. And his parents helped support him. So there's a kind of desperation beyond, hey, I need to make some money in my writing. So that's the reason for one reason for the short stories. Secondly, a short story cycle is intriguing because a novel and yet it's short stories. Because they're interconnected, it has a novelistic feel because there's thematic links throughout the short story cycle. There's things that hold it together.
Do you think if he approached a publisher today, they would just have published it as a novel with intersecting stories? Because it feels like it's a common thing now where you have these kind of subplots that intersect at a crucial point. And I see that a lot in kind of contemporary fiction.
No, because there are some, Olive Kittredge, for instance, is a short stories and they stand on their own, but they're interconnected. So that's the, and or Faulkner's Go Down Moses, which is just a wonderful collection of short stories about race, but they are interconnected. And so there's a difference between a novel, which can be fragmented or piecemeal, and short stories are independent units that could be read just alone, but yet they might be different characters or there's links to them that are clear. Olive Kittredge is perhaps more novelistic than short stories because she's such a dominant figure in all the stories. But Go Down Moses, for instance, has some of the same characters, sometimes not, but it's really about race. So all the short stories are about race. So I think it's an interesting way to have a thematic focus or place-based focus and yet look at different characters in a place, as does Pastors of Heaven. And think of Canterbury Tales, something like that.
Decameron or something like that.
So you can think of those as precedents. And Steinbeck was really interested in world literature, and so he would have been aware of that.
Okay. Let's talk about Pastors of Heaven more directly now. I was intrigued by how you would think about the bookends to the book, the kind of the prologue at the front, which is touches on colonization, the mission system, ethnic conflict, a bunch of things. And at the end, we'd get this kind of almost like decadent commercialization tour bus thing going on. How should we think about the function of the bookends in the Pastures of Heaven?
I think it sets up one of the central thematic concerns of the book, which is about looking at this, the title, Pastures of Heaven, like Edenic California. The idea that California is a dream is something Joan Didion pursues, something that throughout our history, you move west, you look to the west, you start over in California. And even if you think about the migrations, Chinese and Japanese came to California, it was the Gold Mountain from Mexico, it was employment. California represented a new start, a new beginning. So that idea of the golden state and the California dream is evoked in the opening of the book and at the end. Look at this perfect place. Look at this Edenic land. Imagine life in that space, which is always betrayed. Dreams aren't realized. But the opening is so ironic because, of course, the year is 1776. Okay, so in the East, we're celebrating the Declaration of Independence. In the West, you have a Spanish corporal capturing erring Indians or the indigenous population and hauling them back to the clay pits. That's slavery, basically. And so it's the sense of the year that happened, which actually happened. So it's an accurate statement of the Carmel mission and building the Carmel mission. But it's the irony of this enslaved moment of enslavement at the same time, supposedly the nation is celebrating independence. So that what is freedom is echoed there. And then, of course, the Spanish corporal finds the Pastures of Heaven and makes this extravagant statement about it, and he dies of the pox. but his children are, so he has mixed race children. It's just, it's a little, and Steinbeck does this a lot. It's a little condensed history of California in a page and a half, of early, certainly Spanish-Mexican California in a page and a half. You got the colonializations, you've got the missions, you've got the Spanish presence, you've got the mixed race continuation of that imprint. And then you've got the sense of settlement and figuring out where to settle. It's all right.
What's interesting right now, this is not literature, but film, The Brutalist is exploring a lot of these themes on the big screen right now, and it's up for Best Picture, and it's exploring the same dream betrayed, if you will. And so it's something that just keeps recurring, and I think is one of our dominant themes in cinema literature. I want to ask you about, and we talked about Faulkner a little while ago, there are some chapters or stories in this book that feel gothic. You have a lot of hauntings and things going on. How should we look at those chapters? Is he dipping into the gothic there? And is that kind of a pattern that we should notice in this book?
The Tularecito story, say, which is the one that is really the most kind of fantastic and seems a little like magic realism. I suppose I'd say that more because he is encouraged to believe in the world of gnomes and something fantastical. Partly it's Steinbeck's own sensibility because he believed that the line separating the realistic from the fantastic or the imaginary or the superstitious or the world, there's a thin membrane between the real and the fantastic. And so he moves often between that. He himself believed in ghosts and he believed that he had this sixth sense and his mother had the sixth sense and his mother fed leprechauns in her trees and outside her home. So there was that sense that these things really do exist. And we went to Mexico and had a hummingbird somebody gave him that he was very superstitious about because it was an omen. So he believed in some of that. And so you see that in Pastures of Heaven a little bit, especially with the Tularecito story, who is this savant in a lot of ways in terms of his art and what he can create, but also certainly not intellectual.
I was also thinking of Battle Ranch, which is the first chapter in the book. And right, it seems like he suggests in that chapter that places can develop curses or lasting legacies, like humanity can change nature and leave an imprint on it in such a way that it's poisoned. Is that a good way to look at that chapter and what he's trying to do there? Or do you have a different perspective?
He certainly is suggesting there's a curse based on the battles. And there's something, it suggested some kind of revolution, like the Russian Revolution, the Mustrovics, why they left. And so it does suggest that there is a curse. And they pick up on that in terms of the whole book is about people whose lives are disappointed, who fail to realize their dreams. So is it a curse? Is everybody cursed in terms of if you believe in superstitions? Or is it just that people are driven to extremes? Or is it the effect of the Monroes, that some nosy and interfering and unkind people, or well-intentioned sometimes, but nosy and interfering people can doom you? So it asks the question is, what is a curse? Is it social? Is it place-based? Is it bad luck? Is it character? What is the curse? So I think he posits it as a kind of superstition, but I think in the book, it's basically people who can curse one's lives, if you will.
Yeah, I was thinking about fatalism and tragedy quite a bit throughout reading this collection of stories. And it seems like he's saying a lot of different things. And I was thinking about in the context of these, I work in a small town in California, and I was an outsider when I showed up. And there's these recurrent stories throughout with these characters that are coming into this town and they're rejected for different reasons. And the town exists as this kind of amorphous thing. You don't really see it. Like the rejection of these outside characters, it's never, I don't really feel like that's in the foreground, like is implied. Is my reading right of that? Or do you see, how do you see fate in this book and the role of outsiders and their ultimate tragic ends? Because it feels like the fate is decided at the beginning of the story and you just watch it unfold.
Pastures of Heaven, I suppose this is because I've been there, isn't really a town. It's like a valley. So you have to think it's an enclosed space. Okay. And so a lot of the people in the book, they live there. Okay, so most of the characters have farms there. Now, some of them come in, Molly Morgan and the woman whose daughter is mentally challenged, Helen Vandeveer. They're intruders into the valley. John Whiteside has a longer story of coming to the valley, but he's a pioneer. So there are some settlement stories in the book, but it's what happens when you're in a place. Do you get your dreams fulfilled or not? Helen Vandeveer wants to have a place of safety and protection, and she wants her daughter to remove her daughter from the world. How does that work out? Molly Morgan wants to escape the shadow of her father and her father's alcoholism. She can't escape. You go there and you think, I can start over in this new place and escape my past, but it follows her, maybe not literally, but certainly figuratively, when she suspects her father has come into the valley. John Whiteside thinks he's going to build. He's the central sort of character in a way in the novel. He's the settler who comes to the pastures of heaven, thinks he's going to establish a dynasty, has one child, and his house burns down. It's kind of California fires and of destruction. So all these, the dreams and the illusions and the visions that people have wither in the pastures of heaven. They don't last. Steinbeck's favorite of all the stories was the Junius Maltby story. And so he's another settler in the valley. And he too falls into an idyllic state briefly. And I think that's why it was Steinbeck's favorite, because they read Robert Louis Stevenson, they dangle their feet in the river, they talk like in this organ.
That's my favorite one too. It's just, it's so beautiful. And the ending, there's a lot of stories that I had to reread to, in light of the ending and then come back and then revisit and try to re-understand the story in the context of the denouement. And like that story, I think I read three or four times just really so I could imbibe it because it, and partly because it was just such beautiful language and how he told us this kind of relationship. And can you unpack that story for me a little bit? What do you think Steinbeck's doing in that particular one? Because that one's the one that stuck with me the most.
I think that the relationship between Robbie and his father it's pretty idyllic, and they have this kind of beyond, they're outside of any kind of social restrictions, at least for a while, when Robbie just sits there and talks with his father and Jacob, and their conversations are expansive. But when he has to go to school, that's a kind of social contract that Robbie has to acknowledge. And his father says, yeah, you got to go to school. So school is okay. He manages to be a leader, and he has that wonderful group of kids that he organizes, and that great little episode about the Japanese boy who wants to join, and then they decide that they'll spy on his father. It's about inclusion. It's about the power of somebody who has imagination and energy. And so Robbie is a positive figure. And what happens to that story is the Monroes, and this is the most, I think, insidious of their influences, because they don't realize, they're not sensitive enough to realize that Robbie is a very sensitive boy. And to bring him new clothes is to point out, like, you need cleaning up. You're not appropriate for our community. And we're bringing you new clothes. He shames him. He
Yeah.
makes him ashamed, makes himself aware.
Do you think that's giving him, this is a stupid term to use, class consciousness? Is that what's going on there in some ways? Like he's giving him by establishing the class structure, like you are impoverished and I'm going to explain, and you're getting rid of his like signifier points in his universe, his mental universe.
He's made to feel lesser than. He needs charity, and that we have to be careful how we give things to people and how it might be received. And I think that's a story that points out the indelicacy of doing that. And if you just say, oh, here you go, and even the teacher says, I don't think that's a good idea, he's proud, and she won't listen to the teacher. She just, here, take this. And so it makes Robbie and his father much more aware of their status, and so they retreat to San Francisco. So it's a real defeat. It's a real sense of loss of imagination, of freedom, of creativity, of that wonderful adventure with Jacob tied up to a tree. It's play. look what's lost when they go to San Francisco. And it's all because of the Monroes. So that's the curse. It's the curse of self-consciousness. It's the curse of their being meddlesome. It's the curse of their rigid respectability that the Monroes want to impose on people, sometimes in a well-meaning way. She's not evil. She just is too set in her ways to see Robbie's life may have different values than her own.
I want to take a step back and ask you a few questions about critical discussion, because it was interesting for me to read through critical responses to Pastures of Heaven and how people have conceptualized it. And I read a few early reviews. I got that collection that's like the kind of, it's a compendium of like newspaper and like literary reviews of the books, which was interesting in some ways. But Edmund Wilson talked about sentimentality and perhaps over sentimentality in some of this work. And I didn't necessarily feel that, just given the tragic nature of what transpires here. Am I missing something in my reading or understanding of what he was referring to there? I know this is mid-century, but it seems like this kind of discussion about, is he too sentimental or not? I didn't feel that when I was reading, but maybe I missed something.
New critics and others were suspicious of sentimentality. They wanted to think about Joyce or highly intellectual, and authors were kind of, Virginia Woolf, et cetera, were foregrounded because they required you to really work hard to understand the books, or you had to engage your intellect. So sentiment was seen as, oh, 19th century Harriet Beecher Stowe playing on your emotions, et cetera. So it got a bad name. So sentiment, though, is really emotional resonance. And so if somebody asks you to respond to a book with your emotions, is that bad? So I think if you're manipulated, like commercials sometimes manipulate us with little puppies that we're supposed to, you know, feel sorry for and then donate to the, you know, something because they're suffering. You can manipulate people with sentiment. Emotion isn't bad, to feel an emotional connection with things. And so Wilson is criticized. He criticized Steinbeck for a lot of things, but also for creating characters who were like animals. But he didn't really understand what Steinbeck was doing, that we are like animals. We are a species. We are different from the animals in lots of ways. We have the same qualities as animals and other species. But no, I don't think that the book is overly sentimental at all. I think he uses sentiment. Yes, he uses emotional. There's emotional resonance in the stories, but I don't think that the failure of all those characters, the Lopez sisters and their selling tortillas and then being aware of their status, it's silly. And of course they should have known they were prostitutes, but I think that the point is that you can carelessly burst somebody's bubble, however absurd it may be and funny. And Steinbeck was also writing things that were humorous. You might object to Mexican characters being portrayed like this as prostitutes who didn't really think they were prostitutes. But the point is, they're dispossessed from their land. So there's a kind of story of Spanish-Mexican loss of lands in that story as well. It's not all funny. It's sad too. So I think that he balances all these things: historical context, a sense of place, a sense of dreams shattered, all those, they're richly layered. He once said the stories he were written, each one could be a little novel. So you think of them in that way.
Yeah, I definitely feel that way. I think about some of the characters and what they're currently doing after finishing some of the stories. They live on in you. I know that for you and some other scholars, you've seen this book as an important step in his literary development. Can you talk about that and tell us how you think these are connected to his later, more famous works?
I think early books by writers are often finding their voice. And so I think Pastures of Heaven is a book where he's really finding his voice. It's a little more, the prose is a little more refined and simpler than To a God Unknown. So I think he's working to really moving towards his mature style, which is spare. And often he just, like Hemingway, he wanted to eliminate excessive modifiers and really write clearly about what is. You see his, so I think in that way, yes, you see him developing his mature voice. I think it's a really important novel in his development of sense of place and what place means. He wrote a lot of books in valleys, the Long Valley, short stories, East of Eden. So the valley can trap people. It can also, it can be a place of retreat. And as this book does, reimagining yourself. So I think that he, it's a book where he's starting to develop the main themes of, say, The Grapes of Wrath. Ma Jodes, that I'm going to start over in California. I'm going to get grapes and oranges and fruit, and the abundance of California is going to be readily available to me. So that dreams and realities theme that runs throughout Steinbeck and so many California books that is here, I think, in the germ of that whole concern that's his with that throughout his life is here. And into a God unknown, but particularly in these stories. And I think they're very lucid, they're very readable, and lots to discuss in them.
Okay. Before we close up, I have a few questions about books.
Can I answer one more question? You asked me about the frame and I didn't talk about the other.
Oh, okay. Yeah, of course.
I feel like I have to close that loop.
Yeah.
Because the framing device is one of, is can be effectively used in short story cycles because it contains the loose ends, if you will, all the stories in the book. And so the last one, it's tourists looking into the valley and saying someday it's going to be developed. That's so prophetic too of Steinbeck, because he's really good at anticipating. And he says at one point, I have the ability to sense emergent movements or what's going to happen or the inevitability of change. And so what he imagines is this developed valley, and someday it'll be full of houses, which it is. He really knew that was the direction things are taking. But again, all the people who want to live there, no, it's not going to happen. So it's, again, dreams and realities. But it puts it, rather than in the past, it puts it in the future. And so that's, that framing device works really nicely in the book.
Yeah. It's a memorable close. I pictured the bus driver smoking a cigarette on the side of his bus, yeah, looking out of the valley. That definitely sticks with me. In terms of, let's say I have some listeners and some readers who have emailed me about secondary literature to help them understand Steinbeck. Are there certain things that you would recommend for people? Or do you think that task of adding secondary literature to a literary experience is maybe overrated in terms of its value in adding to your reading experience?
I think that secondary reading can definitely enrich your reading experience. A biography is not necessary, but it can be interesting. And certainly Steinbeck's biography and his love of California is interesting. I'd recommend one of the first and the sort of very thorough biographies is Jack Benson's John Steinbeck Writer, published in 1984. But it was the first seminal biography of Steinbeck and remains the towering Matterhorn of biographies of Steinbeck. Although there are other, Bill Sauter just wrote one that's very readable and very good as well. I think that secondary works can enhance your reading of any book. I just published a book of essays on Travels with Charlie, for instance. And I hope that the essays give you a different way of reading it. It looks at the questions of fiction and nonfiction and autofiction and what is this book. And so it gives you different angles into a book. If you read about, say, there's a nice essay on gardens and Pastures of Heaven. So it makes you look at, wow, look at these gardens and how do they differ? Or the women in Pastures of Heaven. If you look at it from that lens, what are these, what are the, how does he portray these women? Or you can look at the Mexicans or the ethnicity in Pastures. And those kind of lenses help you see things you might not have really fully appreciated. And so I think that criticism can help you look at a text in a different way and can often be really revealing, like, oh, I never thought about that, or that's something to consider. I think it can weigh you down too. Sometimes, yeah, if we read creatively and fully attentive, if we're fully attentive readers, I think we can appreciate a text, and then discussing it can open up lots of windows too. So I don't think criticism is necessary. I think it can be very helpful in a lot of cases, but it has to be used wisely. I always tell students, I used to tell students too, when they were writing a paper, write the paper and then look at criticism, which is a heretical stance in a way. But if they thought they had original idea, then if they worked through it, it would still be original. It could be that somebody else had written the same idea. And then, but if you read the somebody else first, you get discouraged and you feel flattened. But if you write it out, then you can look at the criticism and kind of, then you can place the criticism within your own argument. And it's just a more creative endeavor, I think.
And I love that concept too, because if you think it through yourself and then you watch someone else who's been thinking about these things for a long time and how they thought it through, you can compare your kind of trains of thought and see and watch the quote master. There's a number of writers that would deconstruct another writer's writing to see how they did it in order to channel that. And so I think there's a lot of value in that. And I the reason I asked the question before we started recording, I was talking about this book club that I'm a part of, and we read Richard III in January. And in the book club, there was a lot of discussion about the history of English kings. And almost at a certain point, I just got fed up and I was like, I'm here for the beauty of Shakespeare's language. I love reading about medieval kings and things like that. But at the end of the day, why are we reading Shakespeare? We're not reading for the history. We're reading for what he does with language. Okay. One more question.
That's all about balance. You have to balance that.
Yeah. Because it can inform, but it can also overwhelm, right, like you said. Yeah. Last question before I ask for general book recommendations. What do you have any advice for us as we start to A God Unknown? About reading, it feels different immediately. Right. I think it starts with the Veda at the front. You feel like you're entering a different space now.
I just think of this. It started, actually, the backstory is interesting. It was a play written by a friend of his, and the friend abandoned it. And Steinbeck said, let me rewrite it, and took it and started rewriting it and changed it from a play to a novel and then changed the location. He's an ambitious young writer. He puts in all these ideas that he has about basically place and the larger meaning, spiritual meaning of place. And so what does place mean? What does living in place mean? It's a settlement story, but it's a settlement story by a man who has such grand ideas and this kind of transcendent sense of spiritual presence in nature, pantheism, if you will. And to A God Unknown, to who do we worship? Who do we think of as a higher power? Ask that question in various ways. There's a priest in the novel, etc. But it's one of Steinbeck's most ambitious books. He put in every kind of idea that he was really considering at the time. He had read a lot. I've taught it, as I said, and students loved it because it's strange. Sometimes you think, wow, from the first chapter on, you think, what kind of world is this? Joseph throws himself on the ground and copulates with the earth. So you think, what are we reading here? But I think it takes you into this kind of the world of the realistic and the kind of fantastic or spiritual. So it's a great book. It's fun to read. Yeah.
Okay, this is a totally kind of random question based on where I live. Was there any connections with John Steinbeck and William Saroyan that I should know about? Did they intersect in any ways?
Steinbeck was aware of Saroyan and did appreciate his... Saroyan turned down an award. What was it? And Steinbeck accepted it. And he said, I respect Saroyan's decision. So he liked Saroyan. You'd be aware of California writers if you were writing in California at the time.
Yeah. All right, we're going to close with book recommendations. These can be about anything we've talked about or secondary books that we should have discussed and we didn't, or anything that interests you these days.
You mean just general book? Wow.
General, yeah. California related, preferably. Things. I'm always curious what people I interview are reading and what's interesting them
I just finished James and held a book group last night at my house on James, which was really interesting, discussing rewriting a book. So we were talking about that because we'd read the month before, we'd read Demon Copperhead. So you have, that's what makes an author rewrite a book or reimagine a book. What do you, in the case of James, looking at race in a different way than Twain did. That was fascinating to think about and talk about. So I love that. I just read about Robert Louis Stevenson, The Wilder Shore. Love that, about the relationship with his wife, Fanny, and again, a California book that really talks about Stevenson's brief time here, but still an important time here. And then, so that was a really good book. What else do I recommend? Gee, I think that I recommend East of Eden for Steinbeck. They're making a movie of East of Eden. So I think to catch up.
Really?
I think to catch up with East of Eden and think about East of Eden is going to be rewarding in the future in terms of Steinbeck.
Yeah, this is a random question. If you didn't grow up religious or never read the Bible, are you going to miss a lot in Steinbeck, you think? I've got some secular readers that asked about that just didn't grow up in church or religion in any way.
Well, I think you miss a lot in, you miss a lot with a lot of writers, especially from up until, say, I don't know, 1950, everybody would have known the Bible, Sunday school. They grew up with the King James Version of the Bible. So that language, you read the first paragraph of the Grapes of Wrath, and that's right out, that's biblical in its parallelism, and it's the rhythm of the prose is biblical. So that's going to be true for a lot of writers. You miss out on some of the references. Some of them can be casual. Some of them can be pointed because it was just part of their education. Even if they weren't religious particularly, they would have read at some point biblical texts. Yeah, but you can catch up.
Yeah, there's lots of copies out there. I'm sure you can find one.
Exactly. <yeah. laughs>
To close, what are you working on these days? And can we talk about your book, your recently published book? And what are your next projects that you have in mind?
I just published this book of essays about Steinbeck, Travels with Charlie, as I said, and it's called Steinbeck's Uneasy America. Steinbeck's Uneasy America, Rereading Travels with Charlie. And I think it's a great title because Uneasy America is where we are now. So it makes Steinbeck seem very relevant. And I think he is. I think he has a lot to say about our contemporary politics and situation and how we place fiction and what is a writer's obligation to his reader, to text, truth, to his own perceptions, etc. So I really love that collection for that reason. And I'm finishing a book basically on Steinbeck's landscapes and ecological issues in Steinbeck. So I'm finished writing that. And I just did this presentation about Steinbeck in Mexico and what that means, his interest in another culture. Is that being, how do you balance that so you're not just drawn to the primitive, like Gauguin or something, and depicting it in somewhat stereotypical ways? Or how can you be genuinely curious about a culture and just look at the differences between your own culture and that culture and observe that and appreciate the differences in a kind of respectful way? So I'm interested in that. I'm working on that now too.
Dr. Schillinglaw, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Sure. Good luck with your book group and let me know if you need me again.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.